You're listening to Seek Up, the Yoga Inspiration Show, right here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. I'm Keena McGregor, your host, world-renowned yoga teacher, author of multiple books, and founder of Om Stars, the world's first online TV channel. Get ready to raise your vibration and dive into the spiritual lessons from the yoga tradition. Even if you've never practiced yoga before, you'll find kernels of wisdom to help make your world a happier and more peaceful place. So let's dive in. Let's seek up and leave with a little dose of inspiration. This talk is one that came after a one-week Mysore intensive where I discussed a little bit about the Arishadvargas, or the six enemies of the heart, and how we can work with the yoga practice as an antidote for this hardening of the heart that can happen sometimes. I hope you enjoy this episode and stay inspired to keep practicing.
So before we get into any sort of discussion, the first thing I want to say to each of you is just thank you. It's been really, really wonderful to see each of you in your homes all over the world, really committed to the practice in, you know, different spaces, people practicing in front of their beds and with dogs and kids popping in and all of that. It's just been really, really, really special to see. I know that, you know, practicing at home can feel often, you know, just hard to get yourself motivated and hard to really put in the work. So it's super helpful to have the feeling of community, even if that's virtual. And I hope that you felt a little inspired by the virtual community of all the people practicing together. And, you know, from my perspective, it took me like, I think maybe 2 days to kind of get in the flow of like, okay, we can teach on Zoom. This is what it's like. And to come up with, you know, just like a system for interaction. And then I think it is possible to have the feeling of a shared space. And when I'm teaching in person, one of the things that I've really shifted my emphasis on is, you know, in the beginning, I was of teaching in the beginning of my yoga journey, I was very much interested in the experience of the postures and how the poses felt and the anatomical experience of the poses and how the asanas work and that sort of thing. But as I've, you know, just kept practicing, I think everybody who practices for more than 10 years reaches an exhaustion point with being fascinated by asanas. You know, there's some moment after maybe 10 years of practice that the asanas are not that fascinating anymore. Sure, we keep the inspiration to practice, but there's something else going on that's more than just like, ooh, I want to get the next headstand. You know, sure, it's always interesting to try a new pose, but try a new asana, this kind of thing. But in terms of teaching, just to share a little bit of about my methodology as well, is that I no longer feel like the purpose of teaching is to put everybody in every pose, but instead to hold a space for people to do their practice. So this means that whatever space is being held, it's still really passed on to you as the student. And the space that we create is kind of a space that we create together. And then that is, again, a space for you to go into your practice, not for me to come in with, you know, a strong authority and say, you know, do this, do that, do this, this kind of thing, but really to just create a really supportive environment so that you have the tools that you need to go a little bit further and to stay on the path. Because what so often happens is that without some kind of guidance, without some kind of clear direction, then, you know, you very easily veer off the path. And I think for some of you that are home practitioners, you know, it's too easy when you're, if you practice at home, to suddenly, you know, start cleaning your sofa or, you know, to start hatching an idea of, you know, maybe I should try to add these other stretches in right now. And is that a good idea? Is that not a good idea? It's not that you can't do that if it's appropriate, but that it's really easy for the mind to just go on little deviating spirals, you know. We get these little ideas and there's no one watching us and we're just trying to make things work. So it's super easy to do that. So when we come into like a Mysore room, it's not that, in my opinion, it's not that we're there to have the teacher like yell at us and, or you know, this, or create some kind of really unattainable high standard, but that there's an energy that supports our practice and that it's still ultimately your practice and it's still ultimately your body and it's still ultimately your experience and your journey. And that's something that's very hard to communicate intellectually, But as a lived experience, you know, when it's something that gets programmed into your nervous system and you have this feeling, oh, I feel different when I'm in class, I feel different when I practice, then this makes a really, it just makes a big difference in sort of the quality of life after. So this is the sort of change in methodology I have placed, and maybe it's a appropriate even to hold that space online. I start to place, you know, less emphasis on, you know, getting people deep into yoga poses. And, but at the same time, you know, if someone can do, then sure do, but less emphasis on that has to be done in one way and more emphasis on it, how is it appropriate for this student to do this pose? And this, I think, gives a lot of space in the Ashtanga tradition. You know, and as we know, as Ashtanga practitioners, each of you knows that Ashtanga yoga is very hard and very disciplined. It's probably, I can't think of another style of yoga that's harder than Ashtanga. You know, there's no other style of yoga that has these six series. I don't know, maybe there's some obscure style of yoga I don't know about, invented by some like contortionist person out there that's harder than Ashtanga, but I have yet to practice in a class like that. So Ashtanga is probably the most demanding style of yoga that has made it into, you know, a space where there are enough people practicing. For many of us, we're working only on primary series, and you already know that's hard. You know, just the like Urdhva Dhanurasana is hard for some of us, you know. And then to think about that there's a whole second series of poses, and you look at those, you think, wow, those are really, really difficult. Then to think that now there's third series, and then to think that it keeps going after that is kind of overwhelming. You know, it's like, wait a minute, why are there all these poses? Why are they all there? It's this daunting, endless, you know, mountain hike, just forever and ever. You reach one peak. Yeah, I got to the end of primary series. Okay, start second series. Then you get to the end of second series. It's like, okay, great. Now there's third series. Like, when does it end? Like, never ends, you know? Occasionally, you know, Sharad will post some ridiculous posture from fifth or sixth series, and we think, oh my goodness, you know, do I have to do that one day? So super important to understand that from my understanding is that the asanas are there to support your journey. And where your journey is at, there's an asana for that. And the reality is that there are people that have different body types. We come into the practice with different physical potentials, different experiences, different lived experiences, different levels of strength and flexibility. So that if there are, you know, if there are asanas that are easy for you, great. That same asana may not be easy for someone else. And to have the space within the tradition to be able to modify and adjust so that everybody can come and learn and everybody can come and understand the essence of what the practice is really about is super important. Probably like 10 years ago, that would have been a controversial statement in the Ashtanga world. But I don't know how many of you joined Sharad's class last weekend. Would you just raise your hand? You were there last weekend. Good. In the conference, when people asked about the question that was asked about, what do I do if I have a pain or if I have an injury? So like 10 years ago, it would have been sort of super controversial to suggest that anyone modify any posture. But last week we have Sharad broadcasting to the entire world, you know, 1800 practitioners, you know, if you have a pain in your knee, please modify, don't do lotus. You know, if you're injured, don't even do a full practice, just do sun salutations, just do a short practice. And so this is something that I really truly believe in earnest. And I think it can even go further than that and even break down the essence of the asanas into a super, you know, super accessible manner, depending on where you are and depending on where the student is, just depending, you know, have it be extremely flexible. So if we think about that, the flip side of that, however, is that yoga can't just be a downward spiral into nothingness, you know? So I'm going to do whatever feels good for me today. And that's the other end of the spectrum. Very rarely does anybody practicing Ashtanga go too far on that spectrum. Ashtanga, people who are drawn to Ashtanga are drawn to the discipline, and they will very rarely tune into what feels right for themselves for the day. So I feel the Ashtanga people, like, we often need to be told, it's okay to tune into how your body feels. And if it doesn't feel good, it's okay to not do that asana today. You know, because you probably know if you skip a posture, then I'm sure you've all felt, I've felt as well, there's like a guilt. You're like, ooh, I didn't do it. Ooh, I'm bad. You know, then we feel bad. And then we like, maybe you skipped it because it was unintentional. I've done that before where I've gone through my whole practice and I just skipped the posture, not intentionally, I just forgot it. And then I remembered like after the practice, I was like, oh, and I felt bad for the rest of the day. Oh, I forgot. Should I do it twice the next day to like make up for it? You know, so this is very much how many Ashtanga practitioners are. We take it seriously. We take the discipline seriously. You know, if we're told to relax, we're like, I'd rather not, you know, can I, instead of relaxing, can I do it three more times? You know, so very rarely, again, do we have that other end of the spectrum? So, and this is, you know, I feel Ashtanga really emphasizes what many people call the yang element of the practice. If we look at Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, we have the emphasis on the abhyasa, which is practice, translated from Sanskrit into English as the effort. So we have this emphasis on effort. And the interesting thing about this is that the people who are drawn to the effort, the real lesson to learn is actually how to temper that effort with its balanced point. So if we're familiar with this Yoga Sutra, it's abhyasa, Vairagyavyam tanirodaha. So vairagya is the non-attachment, is the feeling, the sensitivity, the letting go. And that's a very difficult thing for people who are comfortable with work and effort to really grasp. If you're comfortable with, you know, I get in my mat, I practice 6 days a week, I do what it takes. Then if it's like, okay, well, also try to relax and take it easy and tune into how you feel for today, because maybe if you just want to, you know, relax for today, that's okay too. We're like, but that's cheating. You know, I don't want to cheat. I'm not a cheater. Right. And so we kind of tie ourselves up in these little loops. People that don't practice Ashtanga. And I end up teaching sometimes people that have no idea what Ashtanga is, but end up signing up for like a full primary series class because they, you know, saw a YouTube video of mine and then show up in class and they're like, hi. And I can almost tell from the way a person walks into the room if they've done Ashtanga before or not. Just the way the person walks into the room, where they put their mat, I can almost within 30 seconds be like, oh, this is going to be difficult for you, or, you know, cool, you know what you're doing. And then the person who's not, you know, the Ashtanga practitioner, the way they walk into the room, it's very much this kind of sensation, pleasure seeking, kind of like, well, this is what's right for me. And I kind of like my mat over here and I'd like this experience. And could we open the window? Cause I like a little breeze and I want to have my little water bottle over here and my stuff like this and all like organized in this really, you know, kind of this like sensory pleasure based experience. Not that that's bad again. And the interesting thing that happens is when that person is asked to discipline, their response is almost what we Ashtangis almost need to learn. Their response is like, I don't know how that feels for me today. I don't know if I really need to do five of those sun salutation A's. I feel already warm. I think one is enough, you know? We would never say that. I mean, imagine saying that. You'd never say that. It's just so foreign, you know? Oh, you know, I think today I don't even want to do all of primary. I'm just going to lie in a bolster instead. You would be like, it's like doesn't compute in the mind. And so it's, again, what's interesting if we look back to Patanjali is that the path of yoga is this equalization of these two seemingly opposite pieces, right? So we have Vairagya, this super relaxed non-attachment, just tuning into whatever you feel and following that in this kind of very fluid, almost, you know, yin space versus the abhyasa, the effort, the discipline. And then what Patanjali says is it's not one or the other, but that these two states together create nirodaha, or stillness. And nirodaha is what we're after in the yoga practice for a couple of reasons. I mean, first, it's what Patanjali defines as the state of yoga, you know, yoga chitta vritti nirodaha. But the nirodaha state, the state of stillness, allows us access into something else that's bigger and grander. So we'll talk about that in a moment. So the question to ask yourself over and over again is which space do I need to emphasize? And what lesson is coming up for me right now?
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things. Make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk offer the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So if you're someone that, you know, gears on the side of discipline, then to embrace a little bit of Vairagya in your practice can be really, really useful. And there are numerous ways to think about how you can embrace Vairagya in your practice without necessarily, you know, just doing a restorative class where you lie in a bolster for an hour. Probably the first and most important tool is to engage in positive self-talk. And this is something that you'll know what's going on inside your mind. So when the days come up that you're not able to do what you want to do, on those days, the negative self-talk will be at a fever pitch. And it'll be coming up to you speaking those, you know, those falsehoods about you're not good enough if you don't do all your practice, you know, you're a cheater if you skip this pose. Like that negative self-talk, on days that your body is truly at its limit, if, you know, you're feeling some tweaks or pains in the body, that fever pitch of negative self-talk is what you want to work with in the state of gentleness, in the state of Vairagya. So then you're able to soften it. You're able to dial it down a little bit and say, you know what, this is, I'm gonna embrace non-attachment. I'm gonna let go of my discipline right now and be disciplined about something else. And this is, you know, a way that you can actually pragmatically work with that. And I can't tell you how many times I've struggled with that myself, where something I used to be able to do, then I suddenly can't do it. And then the negative self-talk starts over and over again. Or an injury, if you have an injury that comes up to the surface again, and then you think it's healed or it's taking a long time to heal, and then the negative self-talk can just start to spin in a spiral. So to work with Vairagya can be to work with changing those negative repetitive patterns of thoughts into something a little bit softer, into something a little bit more kind towards yourself, and letting yourself off the hook here and there. Understanding that is a lesson in practice as well, and that counts also, right? The other important state about Nirodha, and this is something that's a little bit more esoteric, so it's a little harder to understand. We spend so much time in the disciplined aspect of practice trying to train the mind. Right? So we're in this mind training. You know, we train the mind, yoga, citta, vritti, Nirodha, and then we're in, and then what this literally means is that, you know, the state of yoga is the restraint, right? The stilling of the revolutions or the fluctuations, the thought forms that come into the mind. And so we're interested in this state of Nirodha, but we have to ask the deeper question, why are we interested in Nirodha? What is the purpose of Nirodha? Because if we think that that is the goal, then we haven't read the next couple of sutras and we don't understand what the bigger picture is. So stillness by itself is simply a mirror. And a way that we think about this, if we go yoga citta vritti nirodha, the next sutra, tada drashtu swarupe avashtanam. So then when the mirror is clean, then there's no stuff on the mirror. There are no occlusions on the mirror. These would be the vrittis. When those have been wiped clean, then you have a clean mirror. Then swarupe avashtanam. Swarupe, the seer, rests in its own true nature. You can see the truth. That's why we want the state of nirodha, right? And that's the important thing about the stilling of the mind, is that no matter how much you're working for, the idea is to create enough space so that the mind itself becomes a clear mirror. Recently, I was listening to a talk reading a book by Yangi Mingyur Rinpoche, there's a really wonderful book that he wrote called In Love with the World. Just to give you a little bit of context, would you raise your hand if you've heard of Yangi Mingyur Rinpoche? No, he's a younger Tibetan teacher, and he was also an incarnate tulku. And what this means is that they've identified that he is, you know, this reincarnated lama from, I don't know, in the past somewhere. I don't know exactly which reincarnation he is. Some reincarnation something. Write his name down. Yes, I will. Hold on. I'll do that right now. Yes, I will. Yangi. Okay, good. It's in the chat now. Great. Good. Okay. Great. Awesome. So Yangi Mingye Rinpoche was an incarnate tulku, and which means that he, upon his birth, had received the inheritance of being the abbot of numerous monastic traditions. So he essentially just, like, he inherited just from being recognized as a tulku. Oh, you're going to have to, when you get older, take care of all these monasteries. So he was treated from the moment that he was born like a prince in the Tibetan tradition. So at some moments, he got this idea in his mind that it would be amazing to do what is traditionally called a wandering retreat. And there, maybe it's a tradition that perhaps you haven't heard of before, but the Tibetan yogi called Milarepa was famous for doing a wandering retreat. And so a wandering retreat is when you give up all your worldly possessions and you live as a beggar and you just wander with no worldly possessions, no plan, nowhere to sleep at night, no money to your name. You live off of what's given to you and you just exist. Well, so here's Yangi Mingye Rinpoche, the recipient of this very privileged life, in living in with sort of all of the, you know, all of the help that you could possibly imagine. He said that he'd never traveled without an attendant, and he was, I think, in his late mid-30s when he did this retreat. So he'd never paid for anything in his entire life. He had always had someone that would go and buy a train ticket for him or go and buy food if they were going around. He'd spent his life either in a monastery or when he left the monastery to be, guided by an attendant. Anyhow, he had gone on this wandering retreat and wrote this book about his experience called In Love with the World. That's a really, really wonderful book. I think that it is extremely relevant to where we're all at right now, right? So, but he talks about the experience of going on this wandering retreat of stripping away all of the layers of ego. Everything that you've identified with is slowly being just ripped away. Every distraction, everything that you've ever known, just slowly is being ripped away. And for him, it was a voluntary choice, but he had a lot of resistance to it, you know? And it wasn't like from one day to the next, he could snap his fingers and go from being Yangi Mingye Rinpoche, respected tulku of the Tibetan tradition, to wandering, itinerant, nameless, penniless yogi sleeping under a tree. So it's a really, really wonderful read. He talks about his experience as being in one of the Tibetan Bardo states. If you're familiar with the Tibetan Bardo states, these are traditionally taught as things that you experience after you leave this body. But he brings it into teachings that you can experience in different states in this body, in this lifetime. And his experience there was in the Bardo of becoming. And the Bardo of becoming is when you're in this in-between space where the old has not yet died, but the new has not been born. And it's extremely uncomfortable. You grasp for solidity, you grasp for certainty. The mind's natural tendency is to go back to what it knew before rather than create what is new or give space to what is new. And so he was in this space where he volunteered to be, you know, to have all of his identification stripped away. We're not in the space right now where we volunteered for this, but many of our identifications are being stripped away. Those of us who are yoga teachers, we're teaching like this now, you know, we missed that space. So people are losing their jobs, their livelihoods, their whole identity. If you had some semblance of what normalcy was, it's gone for right now. We don't know when it'll come back. So I find this analogy of the Bardo of becoming extremely, extremely relevant and what it does to the mind and the quality of the mind. Well, the reason I brought that all up was in the relation to this concept of Nirodha. So what Mingye Rinpoche, what he's saying I think it's the beginning of the book, was he says that so many people get obsessed with trying to still their mind for the sake of stilling their mind. So then they get so focused on technique. So for example, in meditation, we get so focused on, I need to focus on the breath, focus on the breath, focus on the breath. In, you know, in Ashtanga, we get so focused on, I got to do every breath with every movement. I got to do it really, really right. We get so focused on that, but we miss the point. So he says, listen, you are trying to calm your mind. You're trying to control your mind. Great, do that. But please understand what he says. This is him talking. He says, please understand, I'm trying to get you to realize that you are not your mind. And that, you know, that really, really, really spoke to me. I just felt like, yes, of course, Nirodha is not the end. Nirodha is a clear mirror. But if you stop at stillness and think, okay, well, I'm just trying to still my mind, it's just there, then we never get that reflective mirror into kind of that grand, bigger perspective of, oh, I'm supposed to recognize a sense of identity that's not rooted in the mind, that is actually the path, rather than trying to control the mind. So the purpose of those moments of stillness, which will come and which will go, again, is that clear mirror to recognize, oh, I'm not my mind. But if you're not your mind, then the question is, well, so who am I then? And that's a question for you to, you know, for you to answer over and over and over again, and to seek for that answer over and over again. And that is the essential seeker's question, you know, who am I? Who am I without this? Who am I without that? Who am I without this? Once you're stripped of the identities, that question of who am I begins to really, really bubble up to the surface. And when that's a discomfort I think many of us are sitting with now, the question of I, the question of ego, the question of who have I been and what will become of me, you know, where am I going? Where is all of this going? Because we are also identified with our world. If we, you know, if we have the ego in the small self in us, we also have the ego kind of in the world. And there's this, you know, there's this identification with the world that really, really comes up. That when we look around and we see things changing, it fills us with a deep uncertainty that's very, very hard to sit with. But again, the whole purpose of our yoga teaching is to bring us into this pivotal moment so we can train our mind to be that very, very clear and reflexive mirror. So one of the things I've noticed, a couple of like practical things I've noticed throughout this week, is that it's very, very difficult to find this coordination of breath and movement. Right? But the breath is a crucial point or part of the practice. But having this coordination of breath and movement is extremely advanced, we could say. So why is the breath important, and what does the breath teach us about our practice? So there were two sutras I wanted to read to you, wherever they are. I had marked them, but I have a lot of marks in this book. Yeah. So when we talk about pranayama, we talk about the breath control, that there is something extremely important that happens when we think about the breath. Without controlling the breath in the practice, without moving in coordination with breath and movement, the pure difficulty of the postures will accelerate the breath and disturb the nervous system. And you know, you can think, there are some postures that just you have to think about and it starts to disturb your breathing. Can you think of one of those right now? Then you just think about like, ugh, that one. Ugh. You know, I definitely have some of those. And if I think about like some fourth series pose that I feel I'm doing quite badly now or something like that, then I think, oh no, I you know, or the idea that, oh, now my teacher is going to come and assist me in this pose. You can feel it. So the asanas, without some sort of conscious control of the breath, will disturb your nervous system. So then when we add in the tool of the breath, we add in a really interesting tool to be able to feel and be present with the subconscious mind. And many of you have heard me say this numerous times, but it's so important that we work with the subconscious mind. All of the thoughts that we think, out of all the thoughts that we think in every day, the vast majority of these thoughts live in the subconscious mind. And, you know, there's this, I can't remember which institute it is. It was the Institute of Health, the National Institute of Health or Mental Health or something in the United States. Some years ago had come up with this statistic that the average person thinks somewhere around 60,000 thoughts per day, which is a staggering amount of thoughts. And that out of those thoughts, the vast majority of them, upwards of around 80%, skew towards negative. And that's astounding when we think about that. And not only are they negative, but they're repetitive, which means that they're the same old stories that get rehashed over and over again. And the majority of this thinking, 95% of this thinking, happens in the subconscious mind. So in the it's going on without you being aware of it. So you're thinking these thoughts, which have a power and an inertia. Me too, you know, we all are thinking these thoughts fueled by the power of the subconscious mind. It's driving itself forward without any, you know, without anything to temper it. Without the tool of the breath, the yoga practice, unfortunately, can sometimes fuel the subconscious patterns because your breath gets accelerated, the posture's there. What are the subconscious patterns often related to? We go back into the yoga teaching says our subconscious patterns can always be boiled down to craving and clinging. These two things were either craving for something, you know, or clinging to something, craving for something to go away, which is aversion, clinging to something to stay, which is attachment to pleasure. So we ping pong between this craving, clinging, or attachment aversion. And that all of our subconscious thoughts without the tools of our spiritual practice can be reduced to this back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I want this thing which feels good. I don't want this thing which feels bad. And then we create larger cycles about that and then get trapped by them. Without the tool of breath body coordination, then the yoga practice would just give us more fuel down the subconscious pattern. So if you practice unconsciously, you know, if you come into your practice and you practice unconsciously, you could actually be continuing to work the same patterns in the mind. But if you practice consciously, which is by adding in your breath, then we can begin to see through that barrier between the conscious and the subconscious mind. And this is deeply confrontational. You know, when those patterns that are inside the subconscious mind, when they come up to the surface, this is not like what's in there, as we talked about it, these patterns of craving and clinging. It's not like, you know, there's a birthday present waiting there for you. You know, it's not like, look what I have to dug out of my subconscious mind. You know, it's usually something that's less than a present. We're like, oh, great. Now I get to look at that for a little while. It's awesome. But without that, we'll never be free of it. So this is the sutra I wanted to read to you about. It's book 2, number 52. All right, I'll put that in the chat in case you're interested. I'll just put 2.52. Okay. And the Sanskrit, tata kshiyate prakashavaranam. So we can break that down. Kshiyate is a really interesting one. So this is also, you can find ashadikshyaye. It's a similar root. So we're thinking about what gets weakened. So kshiyate is weakening. What gets weakened? Right? We're looking at avaranam, which is the barrier between the conscious and the subconscious minds, the barrier between one reality and another reality, the barrier between truth and untruth. And then if this kshiyate, right, weakens, the barrier between the conscious and the subconscious mind is weakened, then we have this state of prakasha, which is illumination, meaning you can finally see it. You can really see it. Then there's the notion of bringing whatever is hidden up into the surface. And this sutra is talking about that this happens only through the work with the breath, only with deep work with the breath. It's that barrier between worlds, the barrier between the conscious and the subconscious mind weakens.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And, you know, I mean, my teacher, Pratabhi Joyce, used to say, you know, yoga practice is a breathing practice. Otherwise, it's just bending. And this is, you know, super kind of colloquial way of saying what Patanjali is saying, that unless you are working with the more subtle aspects, then the subconscious mind can stay buried the entire time. You can be doing the same thing over and over again, practicing unconsciously, thinking that you're doing the deep work of the spiritual practice, or even just like bopping around, doing one pose and then another pose. But if the breath is not present, if the subtle aspects of the practice are not present, then that barrier between the conscious and the subconscious mind might not be lessened. So I see this people who maybe dabble in yoga a little bit here and there and think they love yoga and then come take an Ashtanga class and are like, this is way too much. This is super confrontational. This is, you know, it's me and my stuff and my thoughts. And I didn't really, like, it's really demanding and it's really difficult. And I'm not really into this. I had a student who was extremely physically talented here in Miami. She was extremely physically talented. She could do almost all the postures. And then she started doing second series, which is really quite challenging. And then she started to have, for the first time, negative thoughts that sort of bubbled up to the surface. She started to have back pain that she'd never had before. And then she came to me one day and said, listen, I'm sorry. I really see how this yoga practice is bringing up all of my subconscious patterning, just like you say it is. It's bringing all this up to the surface. I come to the mat and I see all these thoughts that I thought I didn't think anymore. And I realize they're still in my mind. And I can see that maybe if I keep practicing, I'll finally be able to work through all of this. And then I'm like, okay, I'm just like waiting for him. I'm like, yeah, awesome. So great. And then she said, but I'm like, oh no, here we go. But I just don't have space for this in my life right now. I have a job and I feel like I really need to do a good job at my work. And, you know, it's just too difficult. And if I go into this whole yoga practice and start working on myself, then I don't know who I'll be. So I'm so sorry. At some moment later, I'll come back to yoga. But for now, I just want you to know, I really respect the yoga. I believe it works. It's just not for me right now. And I said, oh, okay, well, we'll still be here. But what are you going to do instead? And she said, oh, I already signed up for spinning. I was like, spinning? Why spinning? And she literally said to me, because they let you eat a sandwich before you come into class. And I was like, if it's about the sandwich, I'll give you a sandwich. Like, if you need the sandwich, you can have your sandwich. Like, no, it's not that. It's just, they don't make you think about things. They put on music and I can zone out. And I was like, right, if you need to zone out, yoga, this Ashtanga is not for you. You should not come into your Ashtanga practice and zone out. You need to be fully present. It's for numerous reasons, you know? The first of which is what I was talking about before, is that we're not going to do this deep work, this cleansing work. You have to be a seeker if you want to practice the Ashtanga method. It's not a casual method. You know, it's something you have to really, really be a seeker. You know, the Osho, who is a little bit of a controversial, you know, spiritual figure, he used to say that for people to come to the spiritual path, to be willing to put in the work, like the difficult work that we're talking about of excavating this subconscious patterning, he says it's really has to be like a life or death decision. Like, you have to be willing to put your heart and soul into it. And if you're not, then all those temptations, you know, like the, let me just go to spinning and put on techno music and like zone out and rock out to it, it's just too tempting. It's just too seductive. You know, that pleasure attraction is just too powerful of an inertia, right? The secondary benefit that I wanted to bring up particularly with this combination of bringing the breath into the practice is the relationship of the breath to that state of nirodha, that state of stillness. This is actually the next sutra. So this is just 253. So if you look up 252, you'll find the next one. And I'll read it to you in the Sanskrit. Dharanas sucha yogyata manasaha. So manas, let's break that down. So manas is one of the Sanskrit words for mind. So you'll sometimes hear citta, and citta is inclusive of the concept of manas. So we have this Sanskrit concept of manas, the mind. So what is happening now as we begin to coordinate breath with body, with the practice, and we start to be able to weaken that covering between conscious and subconscious mind? Well, now we have this word dharana, dharana, concentration. When the mind, when the state of manas begins to be fit for concentration, what this means, and this is a sutra saying that the mind becomes fit for concentration, so manas has now the capacity for dharana, concentration. And without the faculty of concentration, there's no deep spiritual work that can happen. If the mind is ping-ponging here and there and here and there and here and there, that deep focus to be able to first achieve the state of nirodha, and second, stay present to what is clearly reflected in the mirror of nirodha. So remember, what we're after is we're stilling the mind so we can recognize that we're not the mind. so that we can wake up to that greater reality. If we're unable to stay concentrated long enough to have either the mind still or to reach and tap into the unconscious mind, the subconscious mind, then there's no possibility for the deep work of yoga to actually happen. And this is something that Patanjali says happens when we unite breath and body, when we actually begin to apply the tool of the breath into our daily practice. Whether we do that through concentrated breath work or we do that through combining breath with asana, that is probably one of the most important tools that you can integrate into sort of taking your practice to another level. It's one thing to just boom, boom, hit the poses. You know, you go in, you hit this pose, you hit that pose, you do that there. It's a totally other thing to go into the pose with deep yogic breathing that's really resonant, that's really, really long and deep. If you think about it right now, you can probably identify some places in your practice where the breath is usually not as deep as you would like it. Can you just think about that for a moment? Can you identify some places? Yeah, I see some heads nodding. The most common ones are, you're probably going to agree with me on this, chaturanga, up dog, and down dog. We're like, chaturanga, especially when we jump back and we jump through. This is kind of like happens really, really quickly. If you think back, for those of you that have been doing some of the guided classes with Sharat over the weekends, one of the things that's probably immediately reflected back to you is, I don't stay in chaturanga very long. You know, that's interesting. This is a very long upward dog, right? And so we think, what am I doing in my own practice? You know, if you think about how long that primary series took, the primary series was like an hour and 45 minutes. We're here, we're jumping here, we're jumping there, we're going here, we're going there. What are we doing? How long it takes you to do primary series by yourself, you know? Maybe, what do we think, like hour and 5 minutes, you know? Sometimes, so yeah, then 60 minutes, maybe a little bit longer if we're really dedicated, you know? Barry and I, we did a class on YouTube and she's so easily in and out of the postures. We did the whole primary series in less than an hour, like 58 minutes. And then, you know, everybody's leaving comments, oh, it's so fast, oh, it's so fast. And it's like, well, this is, you know, once you get proficient in the poses, the places where you would use time is like figuring out how to get into Marichasana C, figuring out how to get into Marichasana D, looking up being like, so how do I get my arm around? Once you know how to do that, you know, then we're doing it quite quickly, unless we slow the breath down. And so that's something that really is like taking the practice to a whole other level. I'll be honest with you. I practice quickly. I breathe quickly too when I'm on my own. And normally because I have in my mind, I have something to do later. I don't know if many of you have that as well. It's something in your mind. Oh, I'm going to do this later. So then it's a distraction. The mind is not fit for concentration. I don't have the breath. I'm not inwardly focused. I'm thinking about what I have to do after, you know, or even worse, if distractions start coming in during practice. Doorbell rings, you know, my husband starts cooking something, making coffee. We're just asking questions, talking, you know, people talking to you during practice about non-practice related things. This is extremely distracting, you know, and this is even more present when we're home. We're home, and sometimes, you know, our families treat our practice time as the time to have conversations with us. You know, oh, look, she's quiet. You know, let's talk to her now. It's like, no, I'm not really, I'm quiet, but I'm not really available for conversation right now. So when we think about this, it's not a thing to, you know, get into a negative spiral about, but it's an invitation to, at certain points in the practice, emphasize deeper breathing. And so when we think about this, a couple of things. First of all, sun salutations. This is a great place to think about the complete breath for chaturanga, up dog, and down dog. It'll help you warm up for the practice. And you can do that at a time when you still feel like there's time. So staying just like an extra millisecond here and there in chaturanga will make your body so much stronger over time, as long as you have the strength to be able to hold that there. Skipping the little like extra millisecond hold in chaturanga here and there is a way kind of for your body to just avoid doing some of the work. And chaturanga is not a posture where we want to take it easy, unless we have an injury or something like that that we're working on, or that it's completely inaccessible to us for other reasons. But if it's accessible for you And you can, at least in the sun salutations, slow down the breath so that you can take that full length of your exhalation in Chaturanga, Up Dog, Down Dog, and in all of the movements of the sun salutations. When you do that, here's a way for you to think about how to integrate that into your practice. That your breath is coordinated with the movements so that it's not like inhale and then I raise my arms. That the entire length of the inhalation goes for the entire length of the movement. And you reach the pinnacle of the movement at the pinnacle of the breath. And the same thing happens with the forward fold. So that as you fold forward, you use a complete exhalation to reach that bottom point of the forward fold. And this is, and then it continues, you know, up. You don't need me to talk you through the sun salutation. You understand what I'm saying. So now when you begin then to come into the standing poses, you know, the mind is not able to maintain that kind of depth. It's okay. Return to it at the very end of practice so that at least for, you know, maybe not shoulder stand yet, but at least headstand and the last three poses, that you return to the length and fluidity of the breath so that we kind of get that full circle, that, you know, that full, the full circle of the practice, at least culminating in this kind of breath body unity, which Patanjali is talking about. If you do that, if you spend the time, and I know it's super easy, and the reason I'm bringing that up is that it's super easy, particularly for the last three poses, to again, just rush through those last three poses. It's like the finish line, you know, we're here, we fold forward, 10 breaths becomes three, then we come up, Padmasana, we're like, eh, Upluttahi, sometimes it's one of these like, I was told to check in with how I feel, and I feel like lying down, right? So we don't want to do that in Upluttahi, right? Unless you're injured and we need to modify for some reason, of course, that's always okay. But when you're thinking about the last three poses, these are the most meditative aspects of the practice. These are the most introspective time in the practice. And this is also the time when you can steep in that space of the barrier between the conscious and the subconscious mind being lessened. And it's so important to steep in the space of practice for a little bit, so that at the end of practice, you don't just jump right up and start going back into the old patterns. It's so easy to jump right up and start taking care of stuff. But taking that time in the last three poses helps you steep in the energy of the practice, in that in-between space between the conscious and the subconscious mind, in the space where the old pattern is maybe not working to the degree that it normally is, where there's a little bit of a pause. So it's, again, it's super important to take that time. You might not be able to, at the end of practice, sit in meditation for a period of time. You know, again, we do have lives and things that are going on. But if you slow down the breath during those last three poses, and yes, Utluttahi too, slow down the breath and Utluttahi as well, then whatever moments you do take into your final relaxation will be just a little bit deeper. You might find that the mind is able to slip into a more subtle state, and that there is this experience of, you know, the covering between the conscious and the subconscious mind being removed. So I'm not sure if it's in I don't think it's in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. It's in another one of these little Samhita books where they say that when this covering between the conscious and the subconscious mind is removed, between, you know, between the what they call the veil between worlds, when that gets removed, that there's this experience of light, like actual light that seems to appear in the sort of the dawn of the forehead. And in what is written about is that when you close the eyes, it's the feeling of light on the horizon. And that's something that I think that each of you probably has experienced at least here or there, or can get to that place, particularly in the last three poses. Whenever you have the eyebrow gaze, the optic nerve crossing, the optic nerve is also crossing down here, but whenever you have the eyebrow gaze, both the optic nerve is crossing, and then the whatever energy is worked in the body is encouraged to go up into the brain. And so we have all these kind of like esoteric transcendental things that happen in the yoga practice, and they're all related to an activation of the pineal gland. Pineal gland, you know, it's like sitting behind this center inside the brain. When we fold forward in yoga mudra, the gaze is pushing up here. This is encouraging, again, our different centers in the brain to open. It's encouraging the dialing down of the centers inside of our brain, which are fueled by craving and clinging. And it's encouraging, again, activation of the pineal gland and a more kind of transcendental state. Another thing that goes on when we have this gaze up here, the eyebrow sensor gaze, is it's encouraging coherence between the right and left hemisphere of the brain. When you have brain hemisphere coherence, this is obviously a state of deep balance, but it's also a state of nirodha. When the hemispheres are coherent and balanced, they're also very, very calm, and there's less thinking that's going on, which is extraordinary. I don't know about you, but when less thinking is going on, I find that to be extraordinary and something really, really powerful. So when we're up here, you'll feel it if you really do that drishti and energetically. The idea is not to like furrow your brow and try to see something up here. None of the drishtis are meant for you to try to see something. Like, you don't need to inspect your fingers and evaluate whether you did a good job or not painting your nails, that kind of thing. It's not like the drishti is not like that. Although sometimes we do that. We're like, oh, that was a bad pedicure, which is totally fine. But you make a note of that. And then the drishti is to concentrate the mind.
Hey there, it's Kino here. I just wanted to take a moment and thank you for tuning in to my show here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. Your support really means the world to me. I'm inspired by the fact that you're inspired and that you tune in each week and keep the inspiration to get on your mat and keep practicing and make the world a happier and more peaceful place. Remember, you can always practice with me on omstars.com. That's www.omstars.com. If you're inspired to read my books, you can check those out on any available online bookseller. Just search for my name, Kino McGregor. And my newest book called Get Your Yoga On is perfect for beginners. You can check that out. Otherwise, stay tuned and I'll see you next week.